having a dream tonight, and the Chama comes to visit me in my dreams. She'll say to me the following. She'll say, I remember you. You came to a couple of my lessons. She'll have something sort of reasonably pleasant to say. And then she'll turn around and say to me, why did you waste your time? Why did you waste your time standing there talking about Nechama Leibowitz? And this was, if anyone ever met Nechama, you'll know that's exactly what she would have said about this evening. As far as she is concerned, this would essentially be, for want of a better word, a bit of a waste of time. Now, why do I say that? Because she, when it came to her life, when it came to everything about her, the last thing that she wanted people to do is to dwell on that. She wanted people to dwell on her learning. She wanted people to dwell on her scholarship or whatever, things that she contributed in Torah. And in order to kind of placate myself and to cover the bases, as they say, we're going to do a bit of Nechama on this week's parasha in the course of what we're going to say, just in case that happens and I can sleep tonight without worrying about that. I say that because when I went to visit her after she passed away, you'll see on the back page of the handout, I just want to point this out because it is so moving, and we'll talk about it again. You'll see that on her tombstone there's only one word. And the word there, I hope it comes out clearly, Mora, teacher. That's all she wanted on her tombstone. I took this picture in 1999, I think it was, or the year 2000. I was in Israel. And I schlepped my wife's uncle to Haram Nuchot. I said, I need to go and visit the grave of Nechama. And I'll be honest with you, I was scared to the point that I was thinking, maybe she'll sit up and tell me to go back and learn, because I'm wasting my time even doing that. But thank God she didn't. You know, I survived the experience, and I have a number of photos. This one I tried to produce for you. Her yahrzeit is in fact Hei Nisan, in about a month's time, and she died in 1997. My remarks, essentially, I'm going to divide into three. You'll see on the pages, I'm going to follow this script as much as I can, because there's so much to say. How do you cover the life of a person like Nechama Leibowitz in an hour, or in three quarters of an hour, whatever we're going to do? What I hope comes out of this is that I generate enough interest for you to go away and say, wow, let me go and find out about her. All right, go home. Google, everybody now Googles these days, it's become a thing to do, to Google, and you Google Nechama Leibowitz, and you'll have enough stuff to keep you busy, probably for the next 10 years. There is an unbelievable amount of information already put onto the web, put onto the internet. Go home and do it, and start the process of getting to know Nechama. One of the things I wrote here at the beginning, apart from the famous quote that I remember hearing her say this, about the fact that teachers have heaven because they have their fair share of hell on this world, except that she felt that she wasn't going to go to heaven because she enjoyed it so much, and therefore that was her famous quote, which you can read here at the beginning. I personally had a problem with the relationship that we had with her, and I'll talk a bit about that in a minute, how we got to know her. But she insisted that you called her Nechama. There's nobody who was a student, I don't know if any of you met her or had dealings with her, if you came in and called her Dr. Leibowitz, she would be offended. If you called her Mrs. Leibowitz, then she probably would throw you out of the room. Not bodily, of course, but she would kindly ask you to leave. She insisted that you would call her Nechama. And this, of course, to me was very difficult. You know, I'm sort of a proper English guy, and I'm coming along. And here she is, insisting on being called the first name terms. But everybody, the little child that she taught, and the great Gaon, the great rabbis that she interacted with, everybody called her Nechama, and that was, in her way, the way that she broke the ice with everybody. She was unbelievable in terms of her relationship that she built from the first minute that you had an interaction with this woman. It was on a basis, first name basis. And again, it's just one of those things that anyone who studied with her will know. Anyone who had any interaction, went to any of her shiurim, whether they be towards the end of her life, a lot of teachers had special zechut to be with her in the last years before she died. She gave a lot of shiurim at home. And before that, if you went to Machon Gold in the 70s, or if you were in Tel Aviv University in the 60s, or if you were like me in Meretz in the Kolel in the 80s, she was remarkable. You met her in so many different places, in so many different ways. So again, something which I think is just worth mentioning, and I'm going to sort of preface what I'm saying here with a few general remarks of personal contact. When did we get to know her? And my wife will forgive me for this, but we'll talk a bit about Kibbutz Lavi. What happened was, in 1979, we went on Aliyah, and it was Shavuot, 1979, Tafshin Lamed Tet, I think is the year. And we spent Shavuot, a very pleasant yontif, with my wife's grandmother, Olea Shalom, who was living at the time in Kibbutz Lavi. Those who have been there, this is like Gan Eden. It's a fabulous place. And that Shavuot, little be known to us, I'd heard of her, I have to say, but I didn't realize I was going to meet in the flesh, as they say, in the Chamalivut. So we came down to breakfast, whatever it was, Erev Yonta, and who's sitting there? My wife's grandmother, Safta, and next to her, Nechama. And I'm blown away by this, you know, to me, and they're both having a conversation, I don't know, whatever they were talking about. And then Safta introduced us to Nechama. As Olim Chadashim, and Nechama always got so excited when she met people coming to live in Israel. She was just overwhelmed with the fact that people had come. Of course, she made her own aliyah in so much more difficult circumstance, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And we were sitting there. And we got into a conversation, as you always do with the Chama. There was no awkward silences as far as she was concerned. If you didn't sort of generate the conversation, she helped you out. And we started talking, background, etc., etc. And then we had this rather very interesting disagreement, let's put it that way. She was a woman who basically, when it came to Hashkafot, sort of views on life, you never disagreed with Nechama. It just wasn't worth it. Because by the time she'd reached the age of whatever, 70 or 80, when we met her for the first time, she was already so fixed in her ways, it was impossible to argue with her. And my wife decided, for reasons well unbeknown to me, to have an argument with Nechama. And it wasn't an argument, it was a disagreement. Nechama was absolutely insistent that the best situation for Olim Chadashim is to go and live in a kibbutz, as in Kibbutz Lavi, and we had absolutely no intention, and with all due respect to the kibbutzim, no, it didn't even cross our mind that we'd ever live in a kibbutz. And so we had this kind of disagreement on that particular occasion. It was very pleasant. We heard what she had to say. We didn't exactly agree with her assessment, and that was it. And essentially, I came across her again. I heard her shiurim at that time. She gave wonderful shiurim. That was a Leil Limud, which was unforgettable. And again, over the years, over the next couple of years in Israel, occasionally I would hear her shir, and I ended up in Kolal Meretz, in a Kolal program, in Mevaseret Zion, which is now a very, very wonderful American program there as well, the girls' school MMY, the boys' school Mevaseret, a lot of people have been through that program. And in my time, the program was still Israelis, it wasn't yet developed into an American program in 1983. And what happened was like this, and this is a continuation of our personal connection. It was a Friday morning session, and Rav Uri Cohen, who is still the Rosh HaKola, Be Gesund, he's been there for many years, the son-in-law of Pinchas Kahati. Those of you who know the Mishnayos, this is Rabbi Kahati's son-in-law. Uri Cohen is an interesting person, and he decided on the basis of previous experience, which had happened in Merkaz Harav Yeshiva in the 70s, when Reb Tzvi Yehuda Kook had allowed Nechama to come and teach in the yeshiva. She gave up the university stuff in the early 70s, 1971. So after that, she was kind of available. And Merkaz immediately jumped in, and they invited her to teach in the yeshiva, and Reb Tzvi Yehuda was very comfortable with that. And she gave her lessons, her didactics, and whatever. I'll talk a bit about that also in a minute. We had the privilege in 1983, when I was learning in this kolel in Yerushalayim, in Mevaseret Zion, that Nechama was also starting her course there. And the story is told like this. Rav Uri had to ask a shaila about whether the kolel could allow a woman to teach the kolel guys, right? This is kind of an awkward situation, as you can well imagine. And you know, Rav Uri was very prim and proper, so he went to a posek. According to all the versions of the story, I know it was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. It had to have been, because that was Rabbi Cohen's posek. So he must have gone to Rav Shlomo Zalman and asked him the following question. Can we allow Nechama Leibovitz to come and teach in the kolel? Okay, and Rav Shlomo Zalman, who always gave great answers to everything, he said the following. He said, listen, he said, if you can find anybody better than that, then employ the other person. That was the way he put it. If you find anybody better than the Nechama Leibovitz, then take the other person. I mean, in other words, you're crazy. Of course you'll take her. All right? And this was the answer which he got. And Rav Uri basically said, fine, we'll take Nechama. And she started teaching. And of course, the first thing that happened when she arrived is, how do you divide the men and the women? The Kolo guys were, and even in those days, were sort of a bit religious about this stuff. And they wanted to have a situation. They suggested, oh, I know what we'll do. We will sit in whatever room it is, and the Chama will have a mechitza, and she'll sit at the back there and lecture to us. Somebody had read that in one of the responsa of the Middle Ages. There was a woman who was very learned, and she used to give shiurim on that basis. Okay, go and tell that to Nachum Leibowitz. You're really asking for trouble. Her immediate response was, well, look, listen. The reality is that you want to come in. The reason they were worried is because the Kolo guys, their wives, also wanted to be part of the shir. So the women wanted to be together with the men. So the men said, look, if we have a mechitza, the women can sit behind the mechitza. So Nachama says, wait a minute. If the women are behind the mechitza and the men are in front, and you want me to lecture to you, I'll sit with the women behind the mechitza. You're forgetting who I am. And of course, the Kolo guys immediately realized this was ridiculous conversation. And in the end, they sat like you are. At the moment, maybe the men on one side, women on the other side, but whatever it was. And the Chama lectured, and that was the end of the discussion. Later on, you'll read, if you read some of the historical stuff, some of the history, she had a tremendous problem, not of her own making, in Rabbi Riskin's program. She was employed by Rabbi Riskin to do the same thing in his rabbi's program that he started in the 80s, in the mid-80s. And one of the students there went to ask Rav Shach in Ponovich the same question that was asked to Rav Shlomo Zalman by Rabbi Cohen. And unfortunately, coming from Bnei Brak, the answer was not quite the same as they got from Shlomo Zalman. And the rest of the story is you can read it online. I'm not going to go through it. It's a very painful story where, unfortunately, it highlighted essentially a big issue in the Jewish world, the pirud, the separation, unfortunately, revolving around the phenomenon of Nechama. Because the trouble was, a lot of people accepted her as something very, very unique and were prepared to learn from her, and a lot of people couldn't come to terms with her. A lot of people could not handle the fact that here is this woman who is so phenomenal in learning, in Parshanut, and that obviously allows for the fact that she must have studied for years and years and years, and yet, how can we study? How can we have a teacher like this in a yeshiva? And it was a big debate, and there was a big problem that Rabbi Riskin had to deal with. This is going back 20 years ago. And I don't know, in the end of the day, I think that she ended up not teaching in that program, which was a loss to those people. I managed to be with her for 6 months. And again, as I put on the paper here, her famous thing, which I always tell my students at Stern College, if you don't come with a sefer, leave. And the reason I tell them that is because Nechama said this to everybody. If you walked into the shir without a sefer, out. It wasn't a question of negotiation. It was a question of leaving by the quickest method. If it was on the first floor, out of the window. She wouldn't care how you got out, leave. And you had these Kolo guys who were all hesdenikim, except for me. And, sitting, there was one or two, what they call chusnikim there. And they all sit it. They were literally brought to almost to tears, because what they turned up without a sefer one day. I remember one guy, he came without his Tanakh. She threw him out of the class. And of course, he ran to get his Tanakh, came back in, and everything was fine. She did this because she insisted that you come to a shir, you have to have a sefer in front of you, no matter what it is. Remarkable, remarkable individual. And again, it's something which I try to get over to the students. I'm not quite as insistent as she is that they leave, but eventually they get the message, and the vast majority, do come with a sefer, I'm pleased to say. Again, when did I meet Nechama for the last time? And this is all my personal reflection, personal connection, is 1994. I had the zechud at that time to go with a group of teachers from London. And I have to say, the trip to Eretz Yisrael was just wonderful. There was something called the Torah Department, I don't know if it still exists, as part of the Sochnut, and they gave us shiurim from all different people. But the highlight, and everybody said this always, the highlight was the shiur with Nechama. In 1994, she was already 90 years old. So she wouldn't come to you. You had to go to her. If you know Yerushalayim, you know where I am in terms of description. It's the back of the old bus station, not essentially where the new bus station is, but the old days, the old bus station, the old Tachna Merkazit. There's Rechov Tzvi, and it's number 10. And you would go up the stairs, and you come into an apartment, which I'm not exaggerating again, is probably, I can't even say the size, it's not the size of this shul. It's probably about a quarter of the size of this shul, the whole apartment, divided into three rooms. And what you did is you filed in. On the right, there was a little kitchenette. I remember it clearly. On the left, I think it was her bedroom. And then you came into the main room. And the main room was literally stacked from floor to ceiling with either Svarim or what she called the dapim. And the dapim, I'm going to pass these around, are her worksheets that she started working on back in the 1940s. And the room was brimmed, literally from floor to ceiling, with these dapim. In fact, during the shiur, I asked her a question, and she stopped the shiur. This was after 20 minutes. She picked herself up, and she started going out onto the mirpeset. So I thought I'd offended her. I got really worried. It turned out that the answer to my question that I'd asked in the shiur was found on a daf which she typed out in 1952, and she knew exactly which cabinet it was in, outside on the mirpeset. She had to bring it in. So she brought in a whole wad of them, and she gave them out, and the rest of the shiur was to answer the question which I'd asked. I remember sort of feeling kind of awkward about it, but in the end, Yagdu Torah V'Yadeh, the whole shiur really sort of crystallized in that particular moment. A remarkable woman. When I walked in, she said, "Nu mashlumcha." So I said, "Nechama, do you remember me?" She says, "Better." She says, "Of course I remember you." So I looked at her. I said, "Nechama, it's been 10 years. I haven't seen you." So she said, "Hey, mashlo mishpacha." And then she went through all the names of the family. I told my wife this story, and it was unbelievable. She remembered, obviously she remembered my wife's grandmother and all the family in kibbutz, and then she went through all these different names. This was a woman that, as frail as she was, and by the time she reached her 90s, you could see, physically very frail, but mentally as sharp as you could ever, ever imagine. At 90, 91, or whenever I met her, for the last time, her shiur was literally so much on the ball. It was on the mark, it was on the point, it was breathtaking. And everybody said that when you went to visit Nechama at home, that was a chavaya, that was an experience you will never, ever forget. And I hope maybe there's some people in the audience here, and if not, then you can talk to other people who went through that experience. It was phenomenal. And again, all of this personal connection is stuff that I'm so grateful to the Gurkhas for sort of making me revisit it, because it's so special. This was Eretz Yisrael. This was Torat Eretz Yisrael, something that I just can't begin to explain. It was an experience. How do you convey an experience? You know, I once saw a Devar Torah on this thing, on this line, the idea of wine. I can give you all the ingredients that go into wine. And I can tell you all about the way that wine is made. I can tell you about all the different colors and tastes. But until you've tasted wine, you won't know what I'm talking about. I could give you a shiur for an hour and a half, you know, sort of talking about all the science. You won't understand it. Until you've tasted it, until you've had that experience, it really was not the same thing. And with Nechama, I'm just now trying to find out. I hope that there are some tapes. I hope that there are some shiurim which were recorded, because reading her stuff is one thing, but having experience, the experiential sort of just being with her, listening to the way that she taught, that's something else completely. I just want to talk a bit about her life history, because this is again very, very interesting and kind of unusual. She was born in Riga in Latvia. All right, who came from Riga? I just sort of read today. Happens that Rav Kook came from Riga as well. Okay, just to sort of put a balance on things. And people, it was known as being a very serious place. It was a well-developed place. And of course, I'm sure some of the people know Riga probably better than I do. I've never actually visited Riga, but it's a port town, if I'm not mistaken. And it was interesting. She was born in 1903. Her father seems to have been not only well-educated in Torah, but generally very well-educated. Apparently, according to the books that I've read, that he even managed to study for a bit in England. This was a very highly educated person. Her mother seems to have passed away at a very young age, and she doesn't talk a lot about her mother. But she spoke enormously highly about her father. And in fact, one of the svarim, I didn't bring it with, is dedicated in memory of her father. It's just an interesting thing. He clearly was, sort of as they would say, I suppose, what's the word I'm trying to think of? An all-rounder, I suppose, is the word I would use. He's somebody who combined what Hirsch would have called Torah Derech Eretz, nowadays what YU would call Torah Mother. He was a man who had a tremendous secular background, but at the same time was steeped in learning. It turned out an interesting thing that I never knew. And doing this research, that her grandfather had already gone to live in Israel. It was an interesting thing that her Zayda had made Aliyah in the early days. It seems to have been in 1911. And went to work in Shari Tzedek. And we actually have a family connection in Shari Tzedek, and I have to pursue that particular analysis. Could it be interesting to find out if there's any remnant of that connection from the early days of Shari Tzedek? He died in 1920, and he's buried on Har HaZeitim. So Nechama, I suppose, it's always, you can already see in her blood the whole concept of Aliyah. It was something that, you know, she must have grown up with from day one. And it's an interesting thing. The family did not move to Israel. The family in 1917 moved from Riga, they moved to Berlin. And Berlin was one of those places at the end of the First World War, which was kind of a drawing, it was a magnet for so much intellectual development, intellectual discussion. And there are wonderful conjectures whether Nechama, when she was in Berlin, particularly when she started her doctorate in 1925, would she have met people like Reb Soloveitchik, who was also in Berlin at the time? Did she have coffee with Lubavitcher Rebbe? That's an interesting thought. Did she actually sit down in a coffee house and have a cup of coffee with him? Was she in any way, did she interact with people like, who else was in Berlin? Rav Hutner was in Berlin at the time, okay, who became the famous Rosh Yeshiva in Brooklyn. And it just blows the mind. There is the anecdote is told, I don't know whether she said it, is that she once was in a library and she saw a great scholar sitting behind a pile of books. And apparently that is a reference to Reb Soloveitchik. Now the story is told apparently by Reb Soloveitchik in the name of, that he was once in a library and saw a scholar sitting behind a pile of books, and that was the Nechama Leibovitz. So who is telling the truth in this particular anecdotal phase? I really don't know. Right, I guess both of them sat behind very tall piles of books. That to me is kind of obvious. But it's just interesting. Is there any real proof that they interacted? The answer is no. Her brother, the famous Yeshaya Leibovitz, that's a whole evening, another evening completely, he did interact with Reb Soloveitchik much later. He came to the States in the late 70s. But Nechama, no. From what we know, from the evidence that we have, there was no real interaction between her and the people that later on went on to form what we would call the sort of the pillars of orthodoxy in so many ways. The Rebbe on one hand and Reb Soloveitchik on the other hand. There is a story that we'll say at the end about the Rebbe, which is a very poignant story about Nechama and her whole life, but we'll come to that at the end. Okay, a bit more history, just sort of, again, this is the bit I'm scared of because I know Nechama would not have approved of this particular analysis. Homeschooling. This is a real advert for homeschooling. She was homeschooled. Her brother was homeschooled. It's unbelievable. And they achieved levels of academic excellence. In fact, when she moved to Berlin, she had to go to gymnasium, and she said that was terrible. That was a real drop in the standard of education. Until she got to the gymnasium, she was doing well. And then she found in the gymnasium, you know, because I suppose she had to study all the various subjects that she probably wasn't interested in, and she felt that was probably a waste of time. That's my guess. But whatever it was, she was homeschooled. It's fascinating. What was her thesis, right? This blows the mind. It's the translation of Tehillim in the 15th century into Yiddish. All right, who knew that Tehillim was translated into Yiddish in the 15th century anyway? And she wrote a thesis on this subject. It took her 5 years to write her doctorate. And in 1930, she became Dr. Leibovitz. At that point, there's an interesting development that she got married. And there's a whole speculation about her marriage, a whole speculation about the situation there. She married her uncle. Her uncle's name was Lippmann. She had a nickname for him. I've forgotten now what she used to call him. And he was, believe it or not, 30 years older than she was. It's a very interesting story. She didn't talk about this. I remember in the Shiurim, she never came out with this information. But when you read a bit of the stuff and the background about her, it's a fascinating thing. What we did know, and this has been confirmed in what I've been reading, is that one of the things she did with her husband is learn with him because he was going blind. Over the years, he lost his sight. And she insisted on reading to him not only commentaries from Talmud and whatever they were learning, but Mefarshim, things that she was studying, and he would help her and he would guide her. Also, he was very scholarly. And between the two of them, one guesses that this was a joint effort clearly to produce the work that we know today, the work of Nechama Leibovitz. It's fascinating. He died in 1966. They made Aliyah in 1930. So they lived in Eretz Yisrael for 36 years. It's an interesting story. When they got to Eretz Yisrael, she was employed. She went to work in starting off teaching in the seminary for teachers. Eventually, I've forgotten now, it's something to do with the Mizrahi, and it was a whole setup that they had in those days. And we get to the next stage of her life. And this is a phenomenon. Nowadays, I suppose it's easy. We talk about degrees. in terms of internet and access to college and, you know, all the sort of things that we can do today. In 1942, in the middle of World War II, it wasn't exactly the same story. How did you get the word out if you want people to study Torah, you want to encourage Torah study? And the Chama had a solution for this, which was unbelievable. In the 40s, what happened was that a whole bunch of people from the various kibbutzim used to come to Yerushalayim once a week, and they'd learn with her. She was already getting a reputation as a great teacher. So they came. And what happened was that the students, 12 of them, when they left her course, they were devastated. They said, how can we stop learning with you? So she said, no problem. What I'll do is I'll send you dapim. I'll send you, she called them gilyonot. And I'm just going to pass these around because these are kind of originals. These are from 1950 and 1949. You can just have a look. These were all hand-typed. If you can imagine, she literally sat, how many hours did this take to type these dapim? It blows the mind. And these were sent around the world. Started off with the 12 students, and the 12 became 20, and the 20 became 100. And before you look round, there was literally hundreds and hundreds of people who were studying Torah, the Torat Nechama, as I suppose you would call it, through these dapim. If you look at the dapim, there's an interesting thing. At the bottom, she puts an X against questions. Because what she did was, she gave you the commentary, she then asked you the questions, there was no answers. She left the answers up to you. Now, if you knew the answer and you wrote back to her with a good answer, she'd give you a check, and then she'd send it back to you by mail, and you went on to the next page. If you didn't know the answer, you had a problem. And there's a wonderful story. One of my colleagues in the Kollel, we had one of these dapim in one of our lessons. She gave it to us to fill out. So one of the guys I was with, Svi Perler, who's a wonderful guy, I think now he's in Eilat, he sat there, and he was schmitzing, trying to get through this daf. And the Chama goes up to him, and she says to him, and this is a funny story, she says, your mother finished this in half the time that you're taking. What a put down. And he's sitting there, the poor guy. And firstly, he never knew his mother studied with the Chama. Secondly, here he is schwitzing. We were all schwitzing to get this finished. And then she looked over to the other side of the room, and the women had already finished it. So she sat there with great joy, sort of, you know, basically, for the one time that she got a bit feminist. She never really was feministic at all, in that sense, but she stood there and said, Chochmat Nashim Banta Beita Bina Yeteira. She gave us a whole shiur for about 20 minutes about the whole concept of Bina Yeteira. Look at the women finishing the daf, and the guys, you know, you scholars over here, and you're plutzing, you can't even finish it. And she was great. I mean, she did it in all kindness, but wow, that was a lesson in humility for everybody in the room. Unbelievable. And these dapim, from 1942 till 1971, nearly 30 years, it's remarkable. She basically had a one person, I'm going to call it one man because it was more than that, one person correspondence course. There is a woman now in an old age home in London who is really, unfortunately, very unwell, who told me, who told us, my wife and myself, she used to fill out these pages in the 50s. She wrote to the Chama would send it back via mail. She was the best thing that ever happened to the Doa Yisraeli, to the Israeli mail that they can ever remember, because she got the whole thing, literally thousands of letters, cut some to America, a lot to Europe. She claims that she got one daf, one page came back, it was covered in sand. And this was at the end of World War II. And apparently what had happened was there were two guys sitting in El Alamein who actually, between the battle and whatever they were doing, they would do this page. And they sent it back, but it was covered in all the gunk that they had because they're in the middle of the desert. You know, that's what happened. And she treasured those pages. Apparently they were very special to her because, you know, wow, here you are with guys in the middle of nowhere fighting for the freedom of the Western world, and in the break, they're studying the Chamalivu. It's an unbelievable thing. These are stories that go on and on and on. These dapim, eventually, in 1971, she said, as you would say in Yiddish, she just could not do it anymore, and she stopped. What you do after this shift, you go home and Google Nechamalivit, you will find that there is a heading, Gilyonot. These dapim were called Gilyonot, and there is now a whole team of rabbis, a guy called Yitzhak Reiner, there's a guy called Shmuel Peerless, some of you may know him, American in Israel. There's a number of people who have been now plutzing for the last 12 years, trying to get the answers to these questions. And they're literally going through every page. There's pages for 31 years. I've just got here for 2 years, 1949 and 1950. But you can imagine, I've got at home a sort of few more dapim. It's unbelievable. This is taxing the minds of very great scholars in Israel today to get through the page and to try and understand what she really wanted to bring to your attention in so many details and so many ways. And it's an ongoing thing. So look at that. That's a piece of information. As I said, this is only an intro. You come away, hopefully, from this evening, and you want to take it further. You know, an hour will not do her justice. This is just like a springboard into Nechama Leibowitz. And I hope this is really, if that works this evening, that will be my zeschari amali. This will hopefully be the reward that I get. You'll see over here, one of the interesting things, I wanted to mention this on behalf of the Gorkos, and maybe you had that experience, that she distributed her pages in Russia. I don't know if you ever came across them when you were living in Russia. You never saw them. There is, apparently, they would be translated into many languages, including Russian. And there were groups which were formed to study those pages. And apparently there was a group, I guess in Moscow, that's where I guess it was, that studied Nechama Leibowitz in the 70s, at the height of the refuseniks and everything that was going on. She became, even though they never knew her, they knew of her, and she became the inspiration for so many people in that circumstance to connect to Torah. It's an unbelievable thing. Nowadays we have, a lot of you will have this, it's either got a white cover or it's got this blue cover. I don't know if you've got them over here. The studies in whatever sefer it is. This is study in Shemot. And what happened eventually, thank God, for the people whose Hebrew just was not up to it, because it's very tough. Nechama is really tough on the Vrit side. The Svarim were originally put out in Hebrew. She finished doing them in 1986. So it took her a long time. The Dapim became the books. What she eventually did, not all of the Dapim, obviously, but she took some of the pages and then turned them into analyses. And these analyses were then put into these books. They're five or six volumes, essentially. And this is now available. This is something that one can get. The YU book sale sells this every year. And all I can say to you is, when you study this, be warned. This is not a study which you do. This is not a vort. This is not looking at a Dvar Torah for 5 minutes and coming away with a chiddush. No. This is what you study when you come to a shir. You'll study this for an hour and you'll be scratching your head at the end, saying to yourself, you know, how did I ever miss any of this information? This is a study. This is not a Dvar Torah book. This is the real deal. But at the same time, thank God, somebody called Ari Newman translated these into English. He's left the Hebrew paragraphs where they are in the main so that we can see the original text. But at the same time, he's also given a lot of assistance to try and understand what Nechama was really about. So again, if you look on the page that I've put over here, in terms of the Gilyonot, I've just given you the various bits of information about that. The question of didactics, because one of the things that she did in the pages already in the early days, and the shir that I heard from her for a number of months, she eventually, in university, she put ideas together, not only of analysis of a parsha, of parshanut, but also of Rashi. Rashi to her was the greatest challenge, I suppose, in her whole work in terms of understanding. She would always come in with the following question, and many of you have heard this. She would sit down, you would start learning the parsha, and immediately you would say, but Rashi says, she stopped you in your tracks. What do you mean Rashi says? Before you tell me what Rashi says, tell me what is Rashi's question. Ma kasher l'Rashi. This is Nechama's kind of blade. You know, if she's got a slogan, that would be her slogan. Ma kasher l'Rashi. She would say to you, tell me what is Rashi's question. And you were sitting there, and before you even sort of started talking about Rashi, she would literally stop you in your tracks, and you would have to go back and visit the Rashi again, and say to yourself, because in 9 times out of 10 cases, Rashi doesn't tell you what the question is. He gives you the solution, but he doesn't ask the question. You've got to work out the question. And Nechama insisted, until you worked out Rashi's question, you didn't understand the Rashi. And then, of course, we used to argue with her about this, and she came out with this statement, and I put it on the page in front of you. She said in one of my lectures that I heard, she says there are over 200 commentaries on Rashi. Who knew? I probably could name about 5. 200 commentaries, and she's read them all. And wow, she blew me away. I mean, you know, once somebody says that, and it wasn't to praise herself, she would basically say that, listen, there's a lot of work to do on Rashi. 200 super commentaries, they would be called, on Rashi, and there's a bit of work to do, as she would put it. Wow. That was, again, a revelation, something that, you know, who knew? Who knew? And this was Nechama's incredible gift, I suppose, to the learning world, the sort of information that she gave you. On the page, again, these are thoughts that I'm just putting together, because before we just get to the learning part of the Shia, I just want to talk about her anecdotes. One of the great joys of studying with her was the stories. Because what would happen is that she could not in any way, any lesson, doesn't matter what it was, the heaviest material, would never ever be left without some sort of anecdote to share with you. So I remember, this is a story which is in fact mentioned in a number of the books that have just come out about her, and I remember her telling this story. It was a story about a taxi ride. She always spoke about the taxi drivers in Israel. So she tells the following story. Anyone's been in a taxi in Israel, you know, it's always an experience, but usually not such a pleasant experience, but it's an experience. She always had these major discussions with taxi drivers. Now, again, I get into a taxi. I want to go from A to B. I don't want to have a massive discussion about sort of Sefer Yonah with a taxi driver. But a taxi driver with Nechama, as soon as they realized who she was, they immediately pounced on her. It's unbelievable. This is Eretz Yisrael. And she talks about the taxi driver that she met the day after Yom Kippur. And the guy's looking very sad. So she says, Adoni, Makara, what happened? So he says, Lo Yashanti Kol HaLaila. He says, I didn't sleep. That to me, I would have got out of the taxi. I wouldn't have stayed. You know, he hasn't slept the whole night. Oh, wow, that's a big problem. But he's driving. And so, of course, Nechama, wanting to engage him, says, Makara, what happened? Lama. So she then says, what happened? Did you break your fast on something bad? You know, did you eat something terrible? She had a whole discussion with him. He says, look. He says, not. He says, I didn't sleep because of the haftarah of yesterday of Sefer Yonah. Whoa, that's an interesting comment, right? You know, here you are trying to go wherever you're going, and you're having a discussion about Mufti Yonah. It turns out that this taxi driver was very upset because he read the pasuk in Mufti Yonah, Sefer Yonah, as if it had read God had not forgiven Nineveh after they had done Teshuvah. There's a pasuk there, and again, I have to bring the story clearly to you from the pasukim, but this is just the bare bones of the story. What happened was, Chama said to him, Adoni, that is not a statement in that pasuk. It is, in fact, a question. God is saying, would not Nineveh do teshuva after these events? If you see the pasuk at the end of Sefer Yonah, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's not read as a statement, it's read as a question. The guy listened to Nechama, and you can see, all of a sudden, his whole face lit up. He says, Toda, he couldn't thank her. I don't think he charged her for the ride. He couldn't thank her enough. She had taken a whole weight off his shoulders. And when she got to the class, she said, Mika Amcha Yisrael. Who in the world, where in the world, don't try this in New York, for goodness sake, where in the world could you ever have a taxi ride where the subject of the conversation is Mufti Yonah from the day before, and the guy tells you he never slept that night because he was so upset about the whole Haftarah. It's unbelievable. And she did this. Every so often she would come into the lesson, and she said, I've just been to the post office. I've just been to mail a letter. And in the conversation that I had, she tells you a whole story. And it was never a stum story. It was always a story which had a message. It was always a story which had a moral to it. It was always something that linked to the discussion at hand. And her inclusion of anecdotes is something very special. And I say this because I try to do this. Those who come to the Shia Monday night, you might get fed up with it. Sometimes my stories are repeated. I apologize. But the reality is you can't teach without bringing some sort of anecdote. Break the ice. If you start with an anecdote or if you add it through the middle of the Shia, whatever it may be, because that's part of the Shia. Part of the Shia is making the Shia relevant. Making the material we're learning about Shmuel, make it relevant to the 21st century, to your lives. And if it's through an anecdote or through a story or whatever it may be, so be it. That was the lesson that I learned from the Chama a long time ago, and it affected me. It affected the way I teach and affected so many other people as well. All right, that's sort of by way of intro, personal connection and a bit of life history. For those who want to read about her in more detail, just it happened that books have come out. I can show you these books afterwards. The book in English that has just come out, the Chama Leibowitz, teacher and Bible scholar. This was previewed at the YU book sale just now, 2 or 3 weeks ago, by somebody called Yael Unterman, who seems to be, I don't know her, but her father I knew from England. Father's a rabbi in Manchester. And she spent 10 years, a long time, studying essentially the whole background of Nechama. She's written a lot about her life history, but also about her work. And this is a book which, again, it'll take you a few weeks to read. This is not a book that you sort of read over a Shabbos. So I just warn you in advance. For those who can handle the Hebrew, which is a bit more easy to follow, I would argue, than some of the stuff in the English book, there is one of her students, Chayuta Deutsch, interesting name. Somebody has written this book, Nechama. And again, a lot of anecdotes, a lot of wonderful comments. And again, I'll just share maybe something with you towards the end something from Dinah Brumsky that he spoke about her, but we'll talk about that right at the end. Two of the books. There are a number of books available. Thank you. And, you know, it's one of those things which I think is now an ongoing situation. People are beginning. Those who know it have already gone through it a long time, but a lot of people are beginning to discover Nechama in so many ways. She also wrote, and you can get this on the web, some stuff about how to study history, Jewish history particularly, but she had a general sort of view on history, which was interesting. She's got stuff also in terms, as I said, of Rashi. There was a lot of very, very interesting stuff that she did with Professor Moshe Aaron, who should be gesund. His somebody originates from England. His wife is from England. He's also, I think, he lived in England for many years. Somebody that I met a number of years ago, also a very special man. Many, many people are learning and studying Nechama and going through her stuff. Literally, discovering Nechama is discovering a treasure. What I want to do with you, because as I said, I can't do this presentation without doing some sort of learning. We're going to look at Ki Tisa. Ki Tisa is obviously the big issue of Ki Tisa is the issue of the eagle. And again, I just want to show you something very, no other word for it. This is Nechama. This is very, I suppose, typical Nechama, the way that she would ask a question which really, it floors you. There's no other way to describe it. The question is so, number one, so obvious, but at the same time, it is so challenging. You say to yourself, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I actually sort of, you know, come out with that particular idea? Why didn't I go into that particular analysis? What we're going to look at is the story of Moshe Rabbeinu breaking the tablets. And I'll tell you what page we're on. It's chapter 32. And Perek Lamed Bet, it's page 4. Just one second, I'll just show you the pasuk that we want to talk about. 498. Page 498. And we know the story. We know what happened. Moshe Rabbeinu is told by God. All right. In fact, on the previous page, 496, Moshe is told to go down. Vaychal Moshe. We know that this is the reading that we do on a fast day. We're going to read this tomorrow. And we're told that he's bringing the Luchot down the mountain, and it says that at the top of page 498, Vayishma Yoshua et kol ha'am b'reo, Vayomel Moshe kol mechama b'machaneh, Vayomel en kol ha'anot gvura, en kol ha'anot chalusha, kol ha'anot in shumea. So Moshe is saying, I hear a sound of distress, as it's translated here in the art scroll. And again, what happened was that he got near to the camp. And what does it say in Pasuk Yutet? This is the Pasuk that I just want to concentrate on for a minute. Vayihi kasher karav el ha-machaneh, got near to the camp. Vayarta egel ha-mecholot, he saw what was going on, the dancing and the frivolity. Vayicha'af Moshe, he got angry. We all got angry, but he got angry. Vayashlech miyadav et aluchot, he cast away the tablets of stone. Vayishaber otam tachat ahar, and he broke them at the foot of the mountain. And the question that Chama asked, and it's on your page over here, at the bottom of the first page, is a very simple question. And the simple question is, really two questions. Number one, what does he gain by breaking the tablets? Okay, kind of obvious sort of question to ask. He could have kept them together and give them a Musa Drosh and everything else. What is he doing here, Moshe? And more to the point, who told him to do it? There's no indication in this verse whatsoever that Moshe is being told to break the tablets by anybody. Who is telling him to do this? So this is the question that Nechama wanted to deal with. It's in the Iyunim, it's in the studies on the Parsha of Ki Tisa, it's also on the web. And you can find more information there. But I just want to go through some of the points. When you had Nechama Shir like this, when she was talking on the Parsha, you'd start a journey. And the journey starts essentially going back into ancient writings. You would usually be reading Midrash, or you'd be reading some statement from Gemara, Talmud, and she would take you on a journey through the ages. She would obviously stop off to see what Rashi had to say on her journey. She would go to the Middle Ages. She would certainly drop into people like Abarbanel. She would drop into other commentaries of that particular age, many of whom that we've probably never heard of. There is a tradition said amongst her students that when she got to Shemayim, there was a whole bunch of rabbis waiting to greet her. And who are these rabbis? They were all the rabbis that would have gone into obscurity had she not mentioned them in her shir, because nobody ever heard of them. Ibn Kaspi. She talks about Ibn Kaspi the whole time. I've never heard of Ibn Kaspi till I got to her shir. And she all of a sudden she introduced you to commentaries that she'd seen because she went to the Hebrew Union at the Hebrew University Library, and she pulled out all these manuscripts, and that was Nechama. She discovered stuff that probably you've never seen before. And the greatness of Nechama on these dapim that you've seen is that she typed it all out for you. She was not somebody who left it to you to go and find the information. She gave you the information and then said, right, now you've got the information, now you've got to start thinking. And she challenged everybody always, always. So we're back to Ki Tisa. Let's just see what's going on here. What is happening? What is Moshe Rabbeinu doing when he smashes the tablets? Who told him to do it? It says he got angry, fine, but it doesn't say that he was commanded to do it. It doesn't give us any reflection, any concept of what he was trying to achieve. What was going on? So at this point, you've got to go back to the page that I gave you at the beginning, and you'll see comment number one, the Rashbam. And she always quoted the Rashbam. The Rashbam is the grandson of Rashi, Reb Shmuel ben Meir, and he's known as a Pashtun. Pashtun means someone who gives the literal meaning, literal interpretation of the Torah. Not embellished with Midrash, not embellished with Hasidic Torah, or whatever you want to call it. Trying to be as literal, as direct on the Pasuk as possible. So here you've got the Rashbam, and he says, you know why Moshe broke the tablet? Very simple, look what he says over here. He says, the bottom of the first page that you have, when he beheld the calf, all his vitality ebbed away. As you say in Yiddish, es gevoren shvach. He just couldn't carry them anymore. His soul was going on, and he was so devastated that his strength left him. Whoosh, the tablets fell, and they broke. That's the Rashbam's suggestion, very simple. He said there's no chochmas in what he did, Moshe. He just basically couldn't hold them anymore. So bam, they fell on the floor and they broke. Now, Nechama, what is so beautiful about the way that she handles these commentaries, and you just turn over to page 2, you'll see that she always has tremendous respect for whoever she brings, but at the same time, she will always say whether it makes sense, whether it seems to be on the right derech, on the right track, or whether there is more to say, more to find out. And this Rashbam, she basically says, I don't understand. Look what she says over here. Apparently, it's like the fifth line down, I've underlined it. Apparently, Rashbam, a literalist, par excellence, pashtun, veers far from the plain sense here. He's not talking about the pshat. There is no clue in the text for his interpretation that Moses' physical strength had ebbed away. In fact, when you read about it in Moshe's own words, he says later on in Sefer Devarim, "Ve'tfos b'shnei luchot," he actually took hold of the stones, the tablets, "v'ashlichem ashel yadon," and threw them down. That's not somebody doing something because he's feeling weak. This is somebody, you know, he's picking himself up, he's throwing the stones, you know, think of Cecil B. DeMille, you know, that scene, you know, he picks up the stones, wham, he throws them down. This is not Moshe saying, you know, standing there feeling sort of so weak, boom, the thing fell out of his hand. So says Nechama on the Rashbam, not really, it doesn't cut it, okay? I suppose whatever word she would say in Hebrew, zelo matim, zelo olech, it doesn't work. So she says, let's go a bit further. Rashbam was an attempt, let's try and see something else. So she comes to section B. And again, I'm just going to walk you through this. And this is just one tipa. She does this 10 times on a parsha and on every parsha in the Torah. Just gives you some idea of what material we have to go through, what there is to study. It's remarkable. So she says, look, let's go back to the Midrash. And let's see what the Midrash says. Section B on page 2. So you've got the Midrash in front of you. In one of the comments, there's actually 3 Midrashim that she brought. I couldn't have time to do all of them. There's Avod de Rabbi Natan, very ancient text of early days, and this Midrash, which is Shmot Rabbah. And just a little bit of what the Midrash says. Vayom, section B. Vayom el Hashmideim, lulei Moshe b'chiro omad b'peretz lefanav. That's a pasuk in Tehillim. What does the pasuk mean? Rab Shmuel bar Nachman omar, Shmuel Nachman says, b'shah she'asu Yisrael oto ma'aseh, when the Jews carried out that deed, Yoshav HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the eagle, Yoshav HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleihem badin, God judged them. L'chayavam, he wanted to destroy them. She'ne'emar cheref mimenu v'ashmideim. God says, I'm going to destroy them. Look what it says. Bo lachtom gezar dinam. He wanted to now sign the decree that the Jews are going to be destroyed. She'ne'emar zavech l'elokim yochoram b'ltil Hashem levado. A pasuk again in Shemot. Ma'asa Moshe. So what was Moshe doing by throwing down the tablets? Notal et aluchot miyado shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He took them out of the hands of God, if that's whatever, only Midrash can say that. Kedei lahashiv chamato, to placate Hashem. The Midrash, and again it goes on, the Midrash goes on and says, this is like a person who goes to betroth a young lady. And what happens before you get there, you've written up all the documents and you want to betroth her, and in the meantime she's having, as they say now, there's a fling with somebody else. So what happens is that, what do? Do you decide, and this is something which the Midrash says, in order to alleviate the situation, you tear up those documents. If she's going to be judged as being somebody out of line, let her not be judged as a married woman out of line, let her be judged as an unmarried woman. It may be a bit easier on her. And what he's arguing here is that Moshe did the same thing. He threw down the tablets to make it easy on Am Yisrael. How can they now stand before God and claim to be loyal to Hashem when they're doing this Avodah Zarah? They have a Torah, they have the Ten Commandments, they have the Aseret Dibrot. How can they now stand there and claim to be loyal to that when they're doing what they're doing? He broke the agreement, he broke the document, he broke the tablets. According to Midrash, and there are three Midrashim which say this, and they all come in, really say the same thing. That Moshe was doing it not because he was shvach, like the Rashbam says. He did it because, essentially, he was trying to defend Am Yisrael. As Moshe does all the time. He's there for them the whole time. So he's there for them here as well. Says Nechama again, wonderful, but there's a problem. And the problem is, and again, somebody tell me the problem. Why can we not see that this works so well, that Moshe is defending the Jewish people? What does it say about him when he came to the point of breaking the tablets? Before he broke the tablets, it says one thing about him. He was? V'yicha'af. You don't do this stuff out of anger. If you're doing this stuff out of wanting to defend the Jewish people, that's already a cheshbon. You've got to sit down and think about that. In anger, we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, but still, in anger, it doesn't work. It doesn't fit the context of the verse. It's a wonderful drosh. It's a fabulous Devar Torah to share on a Friday night at the Shabbos table, but it doesn't work in the pasuk. There is an element of anger here which we have to deal with. Interestingly, after that, Nechama says, okay, we've had two attempts to try and understand this whole situation of Moshe throwing the tablets down. And so far, we haven't got very far. So let's look at Rashi. And Rashi, she's prepared to say again, Rashi also had problems with this particular situation here. And Rashi was very unsatisfied with what he'd read in the Midrash, very similar to what we've just read. So what does Rashi do? And it's on your page, section C. And it says like this, Omar, Moshe says the following calculation. Umar Pesach, it's the Hebrew section here in section C. Umar Pesach, shehu echa min mitzvot. The Paschal Lamb, the offering of the Korban Pesach. Omra Torah, where the Torah says, and it's only one mitzvah, and the Torah says, Kol ben necha lo yochabo. Any ben necha, what does a ben necha mean? Says Rashi over there. Rashi bi Gemara anal, divrei amatchil ben necha, umar, somebody who made his actions foreign to God. Somebody who basically did not keep the allegiance to God. In other words, he served idols. If the Torah says about the Korban Pesach, HaTorah Kula, and of course the Torah says he can't indulge in the Korban Pesach, then HaTorah Kula, in the whole Torah, which is represented by the Luchot, Khan, the Chol Yisrael Mumrim, and the whole of the Jewish people are serving idols, which is what Moshe would have thought, you know, when he was looking down, I should give it to them. How can I give them the Luchot when they're serving the idols, when in the Luchot it talks about something which we know, for one mitzvah, they could already be denied the mitzvah. How much more so the whole Torah should they be denied if they are serving idols? So according to Rashi, he sees Moshe's action over here as an act of punishment. Rashi sees Moshe not as someone who is coming around and trying to, as it were, placate the Jewish people because of the anger problem. Rashi says this is a punishment. In anger, he wanted to punish Am Yisrael. So what did he do as a punishment? You're not getting the Torah, you're not getting the Luchot. Wham! He threw them down on the floor. Again, it fits into the context. It fits into the whole view over here. But again, Other Mefarshim are not comfortable with this idea of Moshe punishing Am Yisrael. You know, at the end of the day, Moshe, it's up to God to punish the Jewish people. You know, you can ask the question, what is Moshe, as it were, punishing, when in fact, maybe this should be God's place to do? You know, you can ask that sort of kind of philosophical question. So Rashi, again, maybe doesn't quite cut it 100%. So what do? We look at section D, and we look at Rabbi Yitzchak HaRama, the Sefer, I think it's Sefer Karim, if I'm not mistaken. And again, he again says a very, very similar concept, a similar idea, the idea of punishing. He says the idea of, as it were, teaching them a lesson. It's a shock tactic. When you're faced with this type of situation, it's so shocking that Moshe is just can't contain himself. When? I've got to do something to shock them out of what they're doing, and he breaks the tablets. Section E is fascinating, because now Nechama says, I'm going to walk you out of Spain, and I'm going to take you to Lithuania in the 19th century. And Lithuania in the 19th century, we've got the great Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin. And what does he do with this? Because he, again, you can read a lot about the Netziv. He seems to be more enlightened, certainly about the world. He seems to have a different perspective, and a lot of psychological analysis comes into his learning. So what does the Netziv do in section E? Listen to this. It's written in front of you here. The Netziv gives a similar interpretation, and what does the Netziv do with this? He says, the text describes the greatness of Moshe, how he took the calf and burnt it, and no man resisted him, whereas they had forced Aaron to make it. In other words, Aaron was forced, he couldn't say no. Moshe, starker, he could fight. This was because Moshe, with deep psychological insight, he's saying Moshe here understood the mentality of the people, had not broken the tablets on the mount, but resolved to bide his time in order to do it when it would make the greatest impact on them, shocking them and grieving them to such an extent that they would not have the heart to resist his harsh corrective measure. He broke a unique treasure before their eyes. In other words, what is he saying over here? It's a deliberate educational event. It's something that Moshe understands the psychology of the Jewish people, and he basically wants to make an effect on them. So what does he do? He does something which is so shocking. And he understands, and he waits till he's down. They could have broken them on the mountain, but he does it betocha machaneh. He's in the camp. And when he's in the camp, then it has its major effect, because he's breaking those tablets in the machaneh, right in front of the people. And the people will say, wow, what's going on here? He's coming here, he's breaking the tablets. There obviously must be a message in this. And of course, what we're trying to get over is this educational message, as the Netziv points out, bring the people to their senses. Make them realize that what they're doing is absolutely unacceptable. His anger is justified, and everything here is, again, towards the concept of education. Nechama says, that's great. And again, she's prepared to go with this, but she says, she brings also the Ramban, which I didn't want to bring. It sort of gets a bit too complicated. And I'm just looking at the time. I'm going to overrun my time, but I just want to just share with you the last two points. She basically, what she does in the end, she says, the parish which I think she likes the most of all of this is Ramez Simcha Divinsk, the Meshech Chochma. She moves into the 20th century again, staying in Lithuania, but going to Divinsk. Divinsk was the town of two great Gedolim, Ramez Simcha, the Meshech Chochma, and the Rogachava on the Hasidic side. She doesn't quote the Rogachava so much, but she certainly quotes Meir Simcha. And she says about Ramez Simcha, this, it brings from him the following. And again, an interesting insight. She says like this, from Ramez Simcha, to sum up, she's translating from, bringing from his work, Meshech Chochma on this parsha. Section F, listen to this. To sum up, there is nothing intrinsically holy in the world save the Lord, blessed be He. What Ramez Simcha is going to say is something very obvious, very profound, but really maybe getting to the heart of the whole story. The Luchos were now in great danger of being deified. What does that mean? Till now they're worshipping a calf. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He comes along and says, this has got to be destroyed. So the people are in the mindset, they're looking for a symbol. So what symbol do they look at if they're not going to be able to have the calf? You know what they're going to have? The luchot instead. And those luchot are going to take the place of the calf, the eagle. So what does Moshe do? He realizes that. He says, Gevalt, if I don't do something, maybe he did say Gevalt, he spoke Yiddish, it's obvious. If I don't do something, then we're going to be in trouble here. All I'm doing is giving them a substitute to carry on their rebellion against God. You know what I've got to do? Take these luchot, wham, and he breaks them. And of course, the element of anger is because he's so distressed and so upset and so devastated with what he's seeing, he can't get his head around it. And what is so interesting, and this is the section F that you have, and again, take this away, read it to yourselves, look at it in more detail, find the original if you have the Meshech Chochma at home. It's beautiful stuff. And what it says over here, she brings as a final thought, is the comment from the Gemara. And this I just want to read with you. Tanya, it's the right at the bottom of page 3. Shlosha Devarim Asa Moshe Midata. It's Gemara and Gemara Shabbat. And the Gemara Shabbat says, 3 things Moshe did of his own accord. God agreed with him. In the end, Hashem says, Yasher Koach, you did the right thing. Which item is mentioned in the Gemara? One of them, Shiberat Aluchot, that Hashem agrees with him. He broke the Luchot, he broke the tablets. So the Gemara asks the question, how do we know that he agreed with him? Where does it say so in the Parsha? The answer is, and we're going to read this again tomorrow, for people looking at the laning tomorrow, it's got a bit of a twist now. You'll hear it in the laning. Shenama, because we read in the second Parsha, we read tomorrow morning, it says, Asher Shibarta. If you just turn over to chapter 34, what does it start off by saying? Moshe Vayom Hashem El Moshe, page 506. It says, God said to Moshe, "P'sol lecha shnei luchot avinim kereshonim, make for yourself 2 new tablets of stone, v'katavti al luchot et hadvarim, and I will write on the tablets the words, asher yo al luchot arishonim, on the first tablets, we're going to repeat it again, asher shibata, which you broke." And the Gemara says, Rashi brings this, asher is a word ishur. In modern Hebrew, ishur means you're getting an approval, a stamp of approval, shtempel, ishur. And Asher Shibata means, you know what, Moshe? I'm saying to you, Asher Yasher Koach. You did the right thing, that you broke the tablets. So in the end of the day, and this is what the Gemara says, as she puts it here in her own words, at the end of that quote from the Gemara, more power to thee for having broken them. Alright? You know, power to your right arm. You did the right thing. You broke the tablets, Moshe. And from the point of view of what we've done, just to summarize, and this is just a tip. It's not even more than just a cursory summary of what we've done. We've gone from initially the concept of physical weakness, which we weren't so excited about. We've said that maybe he's pleading the cause of Israel, but then what about the anger element? We said possibly a punishment, a shock value, but who is Moshe to declare the punishment when in fact, you know, it could be that there's more to this than just the sort of concept of a punishment. Psychological impact, as we said from the Netziv, is all well and good, but that seems to demand a certain amount of preparation, and we said that this was done out of anger, seems to have been off and on the spot. Then we said maybe there's another suggestion, the Ramban says that he lost control, I didn't even go into that, but there is a suggestion that Moshe actually lost it, and when he lost it, that's what happened when he broke the tablets, which is a whole discussion by itself. And in the end of the day, what have we done? We've kind of found a derech through all of these suggestions, which kind of combines everything. We're trying to combine the concept in essentially to give us a lesson about holiness. As the Meshech Chochma says, Rameh Simcha says, what we learn from here is this psychological insight, I suppose, about something which is kadosh. That in the end of the day, people were so enamored with the idea of finding an object holy, and were so trained from Mitzrayim to do this, that when they were faced with the broken egg, the broken calf, you know what they're going to do? They're going to substitute it with the tablet. So Moshe knew this. He understood it, and he broke them instead. And then people would learn the really important thing. The important thing is, as they say, it's not the material, but it's what's in the material. It's not the shul that is holy. The building, the bricks are not holy, but it's what happens within the shul that is really holy. If it's a learning, if it's a davening, whatever it is, that is the message of the Egel HaZahav. And what an unbelievable message. Wow. And from all of this analysis, Nechama comes out at the end with this fantastic conclusion. She's walked you through the Mefarshim, she's walked you through history. more to say about that, because everyone can be analyzed in terms of where they're coming from, why Rashi said what he said, why the Rashbam said what he said, but that's not for now. And you've come out with not only an analysis, but you've come out with a chiddush, with something which really is so uplifting, that it's what you put into the Beit Knesset, what you put into holiness, which makes it holy. It's never going to be intrinsically holy. Nothing in the world except God is intrinsically holy. What we do in our shuls, what we bring into our shuls, makes the shul holy. Just as the eger was being transmitted and being made holy by Am Yisrael, and of course that was an unholiness, that was the opposite of what it should be, and Moshe wanted to teach them the lesson that it's not the holiness, the article itself, but it's what you put into the article. Even the luchot, in the end of the day, they're only holy because they're the word of God. And you know what? Bam, I'll break them and show you that as articles there's no holiness there. It's all about what is put into them, the respect that you have for them, the learning, the feeling towards them. And of course, this is something, as I said, from this analysis, you know, if you're sitting in a shir like this, and you're hearing this from the Chama, you know, you go away and you think about so many things. You think about the parsha again. You think about the learning that we've covered. And you think about what she said about Jewish life. And again, by way of conclusion, because I want to sort of bring it to a focal sort of conclusion, maybe leaving time for maybe one or two questions of people that you may have at the end. And just to say the following, after analysis like that, which I hope I tried to sort of get over to you in some sort of way that you'll jump up out of your seat and say, wow, I must look at this a bit more. Let's make some conclusions here. What was her contribution to the Jewish world? Clearly, the contribution number one is learning. There's no question about it. She put learning, particularly learning of Torah, into a new dimension. When you sat in a shir of Nechama Leibowitz with kibbutznikim, as we did back in 1979, and you see how animated, and these are people who knew their Tanakh, they knew it backwards, and nevertheless how she animated that audience, how she got them out of their seats, literally, to ask questions and to debate and to discuss and whatever they were talking about, it was an experience that you could see that there's been a rejuvenation. She managed to put a life into something which had been not lifeless, but just missed that oomph. It was like an extra dimension which she gave. This has been transmitted to, I would say, not hundreds, probably thousands of students. The tragedy of Nechama, and this is something which I can't explain to you, it's God's cheshbon. There are great people that have been in our generation who one can argue, you know, there should be a Yoresh, there should be somebody to take it over. We all ask the question about Lubavitcher Rebbe. We don't understand. The Rebbe had no children. Nechama also, she never had children. She regretted it, but she never had children. There's the wonderful story I mentioned before, just going to share with you. Somebody came to a young couple, Yemenite couple, and they were married for 10 years, and they had no children. And they came to Nechama, and they asked her for a bracha, and that was the last thing that she would do. She would never give a blessing. She said, who am I to give you blessings? But what she did was, she said, listen, I've got just one question for you. Do you love her? She said to the husband. Do you love her? So he said, yes. And she said to the wife, do you love him? So she said, yes. So she said, you should be blessed, continue to live together, continue to stay married, and bahatzlacha. And that was really her blessing to them. 6 months later, they went to Brooklyn, they came to America, and they went to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And they asked the Rebbe for a bracha. So the Rebbe wanted to know what was going on, and they said they'd been married for this period of time, they had no children. And they're not sure, should they stay together, should they divorce, what should they do? And the Rebbe said to them the following question. He said to the husband, do you love her? So he said, yeah. So they said to the wife, do you love him? And the answer came back, yes. So the Rebbe said, you should have a bracha, you'll stay together, v'chulu, v'chulu. The story got back to Nechama, and it's such a beautiful story, because these were two people, Nechama and the Rebbe, both of whom never had their own children. And yet they gave this phenomenal sort of chizuk to this couple in the way that they both said what they said to them. Coming, there was no prompting over here. This was not somebody saying what had already been said by somebody else. It's such a poignant story. It so highlights what these people were about, because their children are their students. I feel blessed. I feel more than blessed. I feel sort of so privileged to have actually not only interacted with her, to known her personally, but more to the point to have learned from her as much as I did, and I wish I would have learned more. It was hard. Her lessons were tough. It wasn't so, particularly if she was about to throw you out of the room, which happened to me a number of times for different reasons. She was tough, you know. She said, you know, you're not up to scratch, out. But at the same time, the concept of this woman who was so seminal in what she did and what she was doing is just unforgettable. I've got it over here. Things that you can take away as her contribution on the last page. Women's mignonim. She was so far removed from that. She would not even comment on this sort of stuff. People tried to engage her in these topics towards the end of her life. She didn't want to know. As far as she was concerned, all she could tolerate in the discussion about feminism was one thing, that women should continue learning from whatever they were learning now, learn more. That was her whole answer to the discussion. She never got embroiled in all the sort of politics of it. She certainly, she never came to the United States. She never left Israel. Once she went to Aliyah, that was it. She was invited a number of times to come and speak, as you can imagine. Never ever left Israel. She said, you know, this is Eretz Israel, this is where I am, and this is where I stay. And when it came to these things in terms of women's, the feminist sort of agenda, going back into the 80s and 90s when it started, she was not in any way, this was so far removed from her, it would not be on her radar. What was on her radar was that the more women would study as part of Torah study, be it men, women, it doesn't matter who it is. That was her whole focus, that was her whole life. What have I got on here? The pedagogue. Meeting a pedagogue like that, you just don't forget it. Every shiur was an experience. Every shiur was a chavaya. It wasn't just going in and sort of just, oh, today we're learning and tomorrow and whatever. You come out and say, wow, that was yet another incredible experience. No matter what it was, that in itself, that Torah should become so exciting. That Torah should be, you know, like when you listen to a good story read by a good actor, you know, you really get excited when you're listening to this stuff. And when you listen to Nechama, not only in her explanation, but also in the way that she presented things. The fact that she would act out. I told Lenny, I think, I mentioned this on Shabbos, that we read, we learned this in our Shmuel shir, that when it says that Shmuel kills Agag, the word that is used in the Pasuk, Vayishasef, and I remember Nechama, she picked herself up when she taught this, and she went like this with the sword, and she said that Hebrew has not only a translation, but it's onomatopoeia. You can hear the sword, Vayishasef, you can hear the sword going, cutting the air. And when she did that, you were literally transported in Nebuchadnezzar watching an execution. It wasn't so much fun. But the reality was that there you were, and she brought it to life. There was no other way to describe it. Vayishasef. And I remember her doing this and acting it out. It was breathtaking. And again, I've got over here, in front of you, the Matseva, which to me is the greatest Musa. I talk about this all the time. I say, look, please God, when, you know, after 120 years, what do we want to put on our tombstone? So, you know, if we all sort of did our professions, you know, we normally try to, if you look at various nuskhaot of what people write, you try and say, you know, you're a good Jew and whatever. She only had one word, because this was her essence, Mora. That's all she wanted, that's all she insisted, nothing else. Because to her, she was just a conduit. There was nothing. She didn't think she was original. She just said, I'm just conveying that information, as it were, to the public, to the Jewish public, that they should become more knowledgeable, they should become more aware. And I'll end essentially with two comments at the bottom of the page. The first comment blew me away. I read this is actually in the Hebrew version of her biography, and it goes as follows. It's the final comment at the bottom. Adina Bar Shalom, somebody called Adina Bar Shalom, I don't know who it is. Bito b'chora shel Rav Avad Yosef, the eldest daughter of Avad Yosef. Now Avad Yosef should be Gezunt, one of the great Gedolei Yisrael of today. He is not famous for his encouragement of women studying Torah. We know this from personal discussion with him, with his daughter, in fact. And we found out about this. It's a whole story which I'm not going to go into now. And what happened was that the Nechama used to give a shir every Friday afternoon on Reshet Aleph in Israel on the Parsha. So listen to this. This blows me away. Zocheret, she remembered, Shekasher Yoshvim Saviv Shulchan. They used to sit around the kitchen table, I suppose, on a Friday afternoon before Shabbos. Haya Avia Madlikat Radio. Rabbi Avadia used to switch on the radio. Makshiv LeNechama Leibovitz, and he would listen to the shir of Nechama. Unbelievable. B'tesumat Lev, with great focus. U'bekavod, and with great glory, great honor. Umorel Yeladav, and he would tell his children, Limdu Mimena, learn from her. Wow. I'll share one more anecdote, because this I just read literally on the way here, just before I left the house. And it's a story from Rav Kuperman, should be Gezunt, the head of Michlala. Many of you may know him. Some of you may know him, I hope. And he had a very strong relationship with somebody called Rav Abramsky. Abramsky was the great, one of the great Gedolim of the post-war generation, who eventually lived in Eretz Israel in Beit Vegan. And Rav Abramsky used to learn with Rav Kuperman. They used to study Gemara together. And Rav Kuperman used to record the shiurim. Well, he wanted to record the shiurim. And Rav Bramsky said, why? So Rav Koopman said that I've been in contact with Nechama Leibovitz, and this is while her husband was still alive. And her husband wanted to hear Rav Abramsky's shir. So he asked permission to record the shir of Rav Abramsky so that he could take it back to Nechama, and she'll sit with her husband and they'll go through the shir. So Rav Abramsky said the following, and Rav Koopman told her afterwards. He said, you should know about Nechama Leibovitz, and he said it in Yiddish. And if my Yiddish does it, okay. If it doesn't, then I'll translate. He says, "Die Yidna hat vos zu sagen." That means that this woman had something to say. If that's coming from Dinah Bramsky, wow, that is something special. The Yidna hat vos zu sagen, she really had something to say. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate your attendance. Bezrat Hashem, only to continue the study because this is so precious. Thank you very much.